Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We actually have good, bad, and crazy martinis today. We're kind of softly applauding over here. We're back to our normal format, at least for one day. Also want to let you know we're sponsored today by Dollar Shave Club. Stop spending a fortune on gimmicky shave tech you don't need. Make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. Get your first month for only $5. $5 with free shipping by going to dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Jim, on to the good martini. And as we know, President Trump is headed on his first foreign trip here in the next coming days this week. And part of that time he's going to spend in the Middle East. And in the Washington Post today, we hear about an idea that I think is worth kicking around. And there's a lot of positives to potentially glean out of this. This is the Washington Post, Josh Rogan. When President Trump arrives in Riyadh this week, he will lay out his vision for a new regional security architecture. White House officials call an Arab NATO to guide the fight against terrorism and push back against Iran. As a cornerstone of the plan, Trump will also announce one of the largest arms sales deals in history. Behind the scenes, the Trump administration and Saudi Arabia have been conducting extensive negotiations, led by White House senior advisor Jared Kushner and Saudi Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The discussions began shortly after the presidential election when Mohammed, known in Washington as MBS, sent a delegation to meet with Kushner and other Trump officials at Trump Tower. After years of disillusionment with the Obama administration, the Saudi leadership was eager to do business. Quote, they were willing to make a bet on Trump and on America, a senior White House official said. Further down, it says the idea of an Arab NATO has been bandied about for years and has always had strong Saudi support, but until now was never openly endorsed by the U.S. government. Officials said the concept fits three major tenets of Trump's America First foreign policy frame. Number one, asserting more American leadership in the region. Number two, shifting the financial burden of security to allies. And three, providing for U.S. jobs at home, apparently through the massive arms sales. Right now, the coalition would be certainly Saudi Arabia, but would also likely include the likes of the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Jordan. So, Jim, you definitely don't want to have too many entanglements in the Middle East, but to get a group of the most responsible nations in the region together to hopefully do some of the heavy lifting on their own would be a nice step forward.
It would, and it's interesting to see who's, you know, cheering this idea and who's opposing it. In that Washington Post article, the Center for American Progress, formerly headed by Podesta, head of the Hillary campaign, generally on the left, says, well, you know, this is something we wanted to do for a while and is not, you know, they're not poo-pooing the idea right out of the gate. Is it tough to build a serious alliance of Arab states that will work together against terrorism? Yeah, no doubt about that. No one has any illusions that this will be easy, but it does seem safe to say that very few other policies that we've been doing in the past have gotten us where we want to go. And so when I see the objections to this from the likes of Daniel Larrison, who is writing over at the American Conservative, he says, you know, building a formal alliance to push back against Iran would guarantee ongoing regional instability for years to come, because we don't have that right now. Right? Right, Greg? Get this. It would fuel vicious sectarian hatreds between and within the countries of the region. Well, we don't want that to happen. You know, I mean, considering how peaceful the Middle East is right now, how well everybody's getting along, you know. And then even if members of this Arab NATO conduct the fight against terrorism as well as they have to date, jihadists will have a little worry about since the policies made jihadism flourish in several countries. Yes. I look, here's the thing. We have not come up with a policy that generates zero flourishing of jihadism. It's almost as if the flourishing of jihadism happens separate from our policies, and we don't have perfect control. And it's not our fault, and it's not a reaction to what we do. So in that case, we should probably decide which policies work best for us, regardless of how other people respond to it. And if this is like if the Saudis are game and the Jordanians are game and all of these other countries are interested, why not? Maybe we become more effective this way. You know, maybe more useful intelligence sharing. You get more useful joint operations, peacekeeping, those sorts of things. I'm not saying, you know, no one's just saying this is going to be easy or that it's automatically going to work, but it certainly seems like it's worth trying. Bravo, Trump administration. Good luck with this. We're pulling for you. We're hoping for you. And this could be a very serious, consequential, positive step for U.S. foreign policy, getting a bunch of squabbling countries that have a certain number of shared interests to finally work together.
Yes, and perhaps they can also put a little bit of a foot down on nations, especially thinking of Saudi Arabia, which has certainly been known to foster radicalism through the school systems, the madrasas, and that sort of thing. But also the name we need to mention with the connection to this story is Iran. This is clearly meant to build up a regional deterrent to Iran and their nuclear ambitions, as well as their sponsorship of terrorism around the region. So let's go back to domestic politics. And Jim, another day, another story related to the Trump administration that has Democrats and the media screaming impeachment, and even a couple of Republicans now talking about it. But, you know, one of them is John McCain. So you got to use Republican in quotes there. Let's go to the New York Times. President Trump asked the FBI director James B. Comey to shut down the federal investigation into Mr. Trump's former national security advisor, Michael T. Flynn, in an Oval Office meeting in February, according to a memo Mr. Comey wrote shortly after the meeting. "I hope you can let this go," the president told Mr. Comey, according to the memo. This is the Times now. "The documentation of Mr. Trump's request is the clearest evidence that the president has tried to directly influence the Justice Department and FBI investigation into leaks between Mr. Trump's associates and Russia." Late Tuesday, Representative Jason Chaffetz, the Republican chairman of the House Oversight Committee, demanded that the FBI turn over all memoranda notes, summaries, and recordings of discussions between Mr. Trump and Mr. Comey. "Such documents," Mr. Chaffetz wrote, "would raise questions as to whether the president attempted to influence or impede the FBI." Later down in the story, they quote the memo in a little more detail. Quote, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go," Mr. Trump told Comey, according to the memo. "He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." Mr. Comey did not say anything to Mr. Trump about curtailing the investigation, replying only, "I agree, he is a good guy." The White House then denied the version of events in the memo, which, from what I can tell, Jim, no reporter has actually seen. It was read to them by a Comey associate over the phone. So it seems like Jim Comey might have more of these to come. You've got folks like Jonathan Turley going on TV and saying this is certainly a political crisis, but it's not a constitutional crisis. So a lot of passion on all sides here, Jim. And in the end, it just appears that while this particular statement from Trump doesn't necessarily amount to obstruction of justice, the president is clearly meddling in an area he should not be referencing at all.
Well, it comes in the context, but let's step back for a second, Greg, and observe. If this memo does not exist, then the New York Times just set off a nuke by accident. I find the existence of the memo quite plausible, but you know what? If somebody said to me, "I've got this report. The FBI director has this amazing memo that basically says Trump was ready to interfere with the investigation into Michael Flynn, that he tried to get him to drop it. This is really huge news." I'd be like, "That's great. Let me see the memo." Like, we can't. I can only describe to you what's in the memo. And you're just going to have to take my word for it that this is what Comey's memo says. And you can't quote Comey saying, "Yes, I have this memo and that's what it says," or "it doesn't." You're getting into a journalistic really gray area. You're putting an enormous amount of faith in this source that they are, that this memo exists and that the memo is being accurately described. And I kind of would feel better if the New York Times had held off on this story until they had at least actually seen the memo. Maybe they don't have a copy, but like with your own eyes, actually see it from somebody who would have access. With that in mind, if this memo exists by itself, does, "Hey, I hope you can lay off him. He's a good guy." Is that obstruction of justice? No, but once you put it in the context of Comey clearly refused, and then, you know, Trump fires Comey, and then Trump pretty much comes out and says that, yes, the Russia probe was the reason he fired Comey. Well, all of a sudden, then that obstruction of justice doesn't seem so theoretical after all. This really comes down to a question of separation of powers. Yeah, look, maybe Michael Flynn did nothing wrong. Maybe he did, right? This is what we have a criminal justice system and police investigators to look into. If they find evidence of a crime, they will go to a prosecutor and the prosecutor will press charges. If the press, you know, and Flynn will have a fair trial just like everybody else, assuming, of course, Greg, that Trump doesn't pardon him beforehand. But this is why people have their days in court. And the whole point is that Donald Trump might think that Mike Flynn is the best guy in the whole wide world, and it's really unfortunate he had to fire him, and it's unfortunate he couldn't be honest with Mike Pence, et cetera, et cetera. Look, It's not up to President Trump on whether this gets investigated. It's not up to President Trump on whether Flynn should be punished for any criminal wrongdoing short of a pardon. That's one of the reasons we've tried to be, you know, keep a close eye on when a president pardons somebody, because that is an awesome power to have. The fact that, you know, that as much as, you know, it's not up to Trump to say, no crime happened here, because that's not his job. His job is to be president of the United States. I've heard some people saying, well, look, the president is the head of the executive branch and he has the authority over the FBI through the Department of Justice. Yes, but particularly when it comes to investigating the members of the president's staff or former associates, we don't want the president intervening and telling the FBI who to investigate and who not to investigate. We want our law enforcement to be separate from our political process. We don't want it being politicized. And that's one of the reasons why most presidents keep the FBI at arm's length in these sorts of matters. And Trump apparently, you know, if this account is correct, Trump didn't seem to not understand any of this. I think the other part that I found most baffling in this account, Greg, is the report that he asked Mike Pence and Jeff Sessions to leave the room before making this request. Hmm. Now, I'm sitting there thinking, if this, you know, this is how it went down, you know, it almost indicates Trump knows what he's doing is wrong. He knows he's not supposed to do this, because I don't know whether he thinks, you know, Pence and Sessions would object and say, Mr. President, you really can't. It's not a good idea for you to be discussing an ongoing investigation of one of your former staffers, or you really can't ask Comey to do this or something like that. Or, you know, but the end result also is that there's no witness in the room to say, yes, Comey's account is correct, or no, Comey's account is not correct. Now, maybe there are tapes in the White House, as President Trump seemed to insinuate with a tweet a couple of days ago. And if there are, terrific. They, you know, let's get that either that tape or that transcript out, because that would clarify not just this issue, but what we discussed yesterday about the the Russian diplomats. If there's a taping program and Trump really is being smeared by people who are making up stories about him, well, then the tapes and the transcripts should verify Trump's account of events and prove that these people are liars. If they're not, if if there are tapes and transcripts that that, you know, verify the accuser's version of events, that's very bad for the president. If there is no White House taping system, that's fine. I just would like the president to stop tweeting about it as if there is one. Then, is that too much to ask, Greg?
No.
Should Sean Spicer be when he gets asked, is there a White House taping system, be able to say yes or no? It's enough. He's starting to look haggard and, you know, like he needs a shave or something.
That's true. I was going to say that trying to nudge the FBI director on a particular course on investigation, not a smart choice. But the smarter choice is Dollar Shave Club. You will get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. In fact, it's a no-brainer choice. You no longer have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that gives you a cheap shave, or spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech you didn't need. As I've mentioned before, Jim, I am a Dollar Shave Club customer. In fact, when I got home from work last night, there was a brand new package waiting for me with a brand new set of razors. They get you four at a time, so that sets you up for a month. This morning, I was thinking, hey, when was the last time I changed the blade? I don't know. I'll just pop it off, put it on, boom, great shave this morning, and I'm all set to go for the next month. So the Dollar Shave Club comes with a great, sturdy executive razor with the Dr. Carver shave butter. The blade glides ever so gently and gives such a smooth shave. Plus, the Dr. Carver shave butter is transparent for a more precise shave and helps to prevent things like ingrown hair, and it also fights razor bumps.
And listeners, right now, Greg's chin and cheeks are as smooth as a baby's bottom. Listeners to Three Martini Lunch can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the executive razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's shave butter for just $5 with free shipping. And after that, razors are just a few bucks a month. That is a $15 value for just $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of four cartridges, and a tube of their shave butter. And after your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at the regular price. No hidden fees, no commitments. You can cancel anytime you like.
You can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/martini. One more time, dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Jim, you mentioned Sean Spicer as we headed into the ad there for Dollar Shave Club. A lot of speculation going on that his days may be numbered as the White House press secretary. And a familiar personality at Fox News is not only pouring gas on that fire, she's admitting publicly that she's being interviewed for the job. And that's Kimberly Guilfoyle, one of the hosts of The Five. She was speaking with the Bay Area News Group Monday night and said the idea of her taking the job or another press role in the White House has been raised by a number of people in the Trump administration. Although she declined to go into specifics, she said, quote, Sean Spicer is a very nice man and a patriot. He's dedicated himself to this public service. Very tough position he's in. I wish him the best, and I know he puts a lot of effort into it. Then she also said, curiously, if you want to be successful and do communications with President Trump, you have to be someone who he actually wants to spend a little bit of time with. First of all, what do you make of the open speculation in the public interviewing process here? And what do you make about the prospect of actually wanting this job?
Well, before we get started, Greg, this is the Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is a member of the La Raza Lawyers Association.
Really?
Right? Right, the one that Gonzalo Curiel was a part of and that everybody said was ipso facto evidence that he was some crazy left-wing maniac. Just checking. You think Sean Spicer's, you know, having a bad enough week as is? There's this sort of thing. I think these sorts of, if you're Kimberly Guilfoyle, you really don't want to confirm or deny any of these sorts of things. The possibility of interviews. And I have heard some people speculating that the easiest way to make sure you don't get a job in the Trump administration is to openly talk about the interview process. Whether Guilfoyle would be a huge improvement or not, I actually am kind of skeptical of this, and it's not. It has very little to do with her qualities. I think that deep down, the problems of the Trump administration are stemming from the decision-making of the president. It's not that Sean Spicer is doing a bad job. And if he is, look, if you send him out with 1 hour's warning about the firing of Jim Comey, just how good a job do you think he's going to do? You know, that in the end, the problem stems from the way Trump expects the work to be done and the types of decisions he has to defend. You know, I mentioned in the Morning Joel today, how much Republicans are being asked to defend not Trump policies, not the Trump agenda, not, you know, healthcare reform, tax reform, infrastructure bill, foreign policy, and that kind of stuff. They're asked to defend Trump's decision making, which seems very impulsive, very much based on trusting his own counsel and nobody else's. Kind of off it's ad hoc, it's off the cuff, it's unpredictable. Trump apparently went into the Lester Holt interview with absolutely no preparation and just decided to wing it. Look, you know, when the president decides to wing it on some of these big decisions and his big appearances, just what can a White House press secretary do? There's got to be some coordination there. There's got to be some preparation. You got to help the White House press secretary do his job. And it doesn't appear that's the case. And for anyone wondering, I think I've had like 3 or 4 conversations with Sean Spicer in my whole life. I'm not a particularly huge fan of the guy. I just think he's getting, you know, he's turning into the scapegoat here. That I don't think there's too many people who could do a much better job than he's doing right now because of the circumstances. That there's just seems like there's almost no coordination on what the message is going to be. And out of nowhere at any given day, you know, Trump can go on Twitter or he can, you know, say something in an interview, or he can suddenly make these giant changes and these sudden, you know, announcements and things like that without bringing everybody in on the decision-making process so everybody's prepared to defend that decision. So Spicer, Guilfoyle, look, I'm not sure it's going to make that much of a difference. It's starting to feel a little bit like the, you know, to use the cliche, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
This would never happen because he's not a big Trump fan. But if you're going to pluck somebody from the five to really shake up the White House press room, wouldn't you go with Gutfeld? I mean, you have to lower the podium quite a bit. But his sparring with the press would be must-see TV.
Well, I'm just going to say, Greg, is there anybody on the five who has experience being a White House press? I mean, Dana Perino, I know she was never Trump. I think she clearly was a Trump skeptic. But can you imagine if Dana Perino came back?
No.
Can you imagine like the giant sigh of relief in the White House press corps? Right? I mean, I think very highly of her. She's been very nice to me over the years. But observe it, like she was always professional. But again, the Bush White House worked differently than this one. And I think in the end, Trump has to be more of a team player. He's actually assembled a pretty darn good team around him. Now, he's got to let everybody do their parts to help enact his agenda instead of just, you know, there are times it just seems like he's acting like he's still running a reality show or a small family, a family business with a close-knit group and mostly relying on the input of Ivanka and Jared. And in the end, you know, you've got a good cabinet there, Mr. President. You've got a good team around you. Help them help you. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've turned into Jerry Maguire.
You're right about Dana Perino. Lovely person and an accomplished, polished professional. Not a chance in the world that she would take the job right now, I don't think, if it was offered to her. But just for the very reasons you've just explained here in this martini, I don't think that's an atmosphere that she would be attracted to at all. But we'll see if Kimberly gets the job. We'll see if it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders. We'll see if Spicer hangs on longer than most people expect. But one more round of speculation in Washington, because we don't have enough of that going on. So, Jim, amazing day. We actually had a good, bad, and a crazy today. Amazing.
Yeah, things are back to normal, sort of.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please don't forget to visit our good friends at Dollar Shave Club. That's dollarshaveclub.com/martini. And please join us Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.